accession number 28729, reel 5.
Reel 5.
Yes, I was talking about the swimming pool, I think. Well, it was an old fort, been demolished, but they allowed the water to go be retained in this area, and we used that as a swimming pool. This is Aden, by the way, so I've jumped a little bit because I mentioned Bombay. Bombay is a city. It was fascinating in so much that the difference of architecture. And I always thought that, well, they are. The Indians are a bit gaudy with their decoration. They love their golds and greens and reds and oranges and so forth. And they have some marvellous buildings, but they were painted all these terrible colours. So it was a treat to see some British architecture at its best. And I think they're still standing now, the old railway station, the government buildings. From Bombay, we went to a place called Ceylon, which is Sri Lanka now, isn't it? They changed it. Even Bombay, that's been changed. Mambu or something of nature. I don't know. Ceylon was fascinating because I went to visit the elephant temple. And there were actually elephants there. And these stone elephants, effigies of elephants, they're massive, great things. Mostly in ruins, but it's a fascinating place. And we're talking of 2,000, 2,500 years old. From Ceylon, we went down, we got into Singapore. Again, weaving our way through the hundreds of islands as you go into Singapore Harbour. And the population, the boats and everything, well, it was really, really humming, it was. From Singapore, we embarked, said goodbye to the old SS Orduna. It served us well. And we went to a place, I think it's called Nee Soon, and we were doing 2 weeks jungle training.
What did that involve?
Actually encountering the enemy in the jungle, to see what the jungle was like. We weren't going to encounter the enemy, but they'd actually put some chaps in there for us to sort of meet up with, and to see how easy it was for them to hide themselves. And it was. That first night was frightening. We had to build our own bashes, we call it, and they were small tents. And we had poncho capes, and we'd make the poncho cape into a roof, and the side we'd use called atab, which is like a palm leaf split in half, and we'd build that up to the side. Made by and experienced by NCOs from the Suffolk Regiment and other regiments that were teaching us. But when the darkness occurred, we had to, they call it stand to, and we had to guard the perimeter of the camp. So when you went to bed, you stood there for half an hour to an hour, and then stand down, and then go to your bashes. And it was so dark, you couldn't have a light. You even had to shield your cigarette with your cup of your hand. And when all the lights were out, and the enemy was occurring and appearing all around you, these lights were coming up all over the place, and then there's rows of lights appearing. And there's something moving across the front of us with a light on. And it was trees and animals with phosphorus on them. Actually had the tree had phosphorus on the bark. And you could see it all running all the way up. Fireflies, they got lights in their backsides. And they were flickering on and off, just like a light, like a cigarette burning. Very nervous it was. And the NCOs used to come around and say, no, don't worry, this is science of this. And next morning, we'd look for these animals or creatures. And you know, I'd have a job to see them, because some of them were camouflaged like leaves. And some of them were like sticks. Some of them were like barks of trees. Creatures. We'd never encountered anything like this before. So we stayed out there for 2 or 3 days.
Was it a frightening experience at the night times? Not only from what you could see, but the noises
of the gibbons, and also the peacocks. They have wild peacocks there, and they cry out. You listen to them over here, and to cry out there as well. That's happening all night. Then you hear like a hissing noise and a flapping noise, and they're huge bats, massive great things, must have a 3-foot wingspan. They're called fruit bats. And they go hunting in the daytime, and at night time they come roosting. And if you're anywhere near the tree, they're roosting. Hundreds of them land in these trees. That's an experience as well. Of course you get the pigs, the wild pigs, they're snuffling and snorting around you. You don't know what's happening, because you don't know if it's enemy or what. Even all the way through the years I was out there, any noise, you had to try and distinguish them, what it was. Was it alien? Was it friendly?
Was that a good acclimatisation to it, that training?
Well, I think it was, because, as I said before, you had little spinneys to go through. Now, here we are, we're in the jungle. The jungle. It had a peculiar smell of fungi and rotting vegetables. And eerie sounds of drilling beetles, and I say the gibbon monkeys and so forth. And it had a claustrophobic attitude to it. You were walking along a narrow track, and it was wider than normal, because when you eventually went into the jungle, there was hardly any tracks at all. But this was the training area, and of course you could see where people had gone before. And we'd walk past, in those 3 days we were out, the first 3 days, we'd walk past two lots of groups of blokes, and we didn't even see them. And they were less than 5 yards away. You couldn't even see them. So I said, I made an inquiry when we got back, how the hell are we supposed to spot our enemy? He said, well, you have to wait for their actions first. If they come out and start firing, you've got to react. I hope that some of you get them. And we found out afterwards that any encounter only lasts seconds. That's it, so quick.
What were you taught at that stage with the kind of proper jungle training to do if you had an encounter?
The action, we had to do patrols, as I explained before, the spread out patrol, but not so much on the 3 to 5 yards, it was probably 3 yards apart. Enough to swing your weapon around, and because you can lose contact with them. If they turn a left, make a left or a right, and the last two blokes haven't seen you, they don't know where you've gone. So you've got to make sure that. And the last man, Tao and Charlie, has to keep turning and listening. So we've got to be careful, aware of the fact that he's stopping and listening. Is somebody following us? Yes, they taught us how to match our firepower with them. And we had got a good firepower with all our automatic weapons. With 12 of us there, we had 2 Brens, 2 Stens, and the rest were rifles.
How would they be distributed amongst the patrol? What would they be telling you how to distribute?
You're broken into 3 sections, and each section either 3 or 4 men. So it's either 9 men or 12 men. So you have the lead section, the middle section, and the rear section. And they're in threes. So you have the leading scout usually has an automatic weapon. They're short weapons, and it's either a Sten gun, and later on it became an Owen gun. That's right, yeah. There was an Australian gun, that was. And that was the favourite. Then we had the American carbine, but most of the NCOs and officers got them. But the reason why they got the Owen gun is because it's short, so it's manoeuvrable, and the leading scout has to chop his way through. Secondly is the fact that if they do encounter to the front, he could get 5 shots off. As one rifleman could get probably 1 or 2, right? Because we have to do bolt action. So that was a better thing as well. Then the next behind him would be probably a Bren man, carrying a Bren, then a rifleman. Then again, an automatic man or a Bren, or a rifleman, then another Bren man. Then a rifleman. Then the rear section would have one automatic, either an Owen gun or a Sten gun, and 2 rifles. Sometimes we used to take another weapon out, which was called an EY. And this was, it was short for extra yield. It was one of the old First World War rifles, bound with copper around its barrel and stock. So if it did explode, it wouldn't explode too violently in a person's face. And on the top of that was a cup, a metal cup, the size to hold a hand grenade. And the hand grenade had a large base plate. So you would put a blank cartridge in the breech, and then put the hand grenade with its base plate to its bottom and drop it down the cup. We then had a cover over that. Mind you, don't forget, the hand grenade's gone in with a pin pulled, but the lever is pressed against the cup, so it can't explode. But once it's discharged, it's the same as throwing it. So to keep that hand grenade in, the army had never given us anything at all, so we made our own covers. We didn't have plastic then, but we had like oil cloth. So we made an oil cloth bag to go over the top and tied it securely. And if need be, that hand grenade would go through that oil cloth. So we didn't have to take the oil cloth off. And that was the idea, was that it would throw a hand grenade to the length of a football field. The only thing of doing that, you had to make sure that you hadn't got any overhead branches, because it bounced back and you'd be the receiver of the weapon. So sometimes we used 12, 13 or 14 men. Sometimes 20 men are going in a thing. It all depends.
Where would the patrol leader be, an officer, an NCO?
He'd be in the first section, just behind, or just two men behind the leader. Mostly at the front to give his orders. And then we were taught orders. There were visual orders by sign language. Fingers, fore and thumb in a C formation meant hand grenade. Hand spread over your face, with your palm, your fingers ends ticking to your hand, would be ambush, and he'd point left or right. Thumbs up would be all clear, thumbs down would be enemy. Individuals like that, and also spread of arms would be spread yourselves out. You're too close, we've bunched up. When you do get a tendency to bunch up, because if the leading scout encounters a very thick undergrowth, he has a job to cut through. Now, the leading scout usually gets relieved, but sometimes, again, the vanity of people, they would never let go, they would hold on. Same as we had a radio set, a radio man with us, and that radio set was £30 with a massive great battery in it. And he'd carry that, and they very seldom used to give them up. Bren gunners would never, very seldom give their Bren up, and Bren is an awkward weapon to carry. It's long, cumbersome, heavy, but a reliable one. That's why we had that justification of carrying it out. I remember one occasion where the officer shouted out, "Enemy left, fire." We couldn't see anything, but we fired to the left. And we had to get out of the way because this tree was falling down. I'd cut this tree down. It was only about 6-inch girth. But I kept the gun so steady that I cut this tree in half, and it fell towards us. We had to get out of the way. And in the meantime, the officer had killed two enemies himself. He was a greedy man, he was. He wouldn't give us a chance to kill. Accurate man as well, and cool as a cucumber.
With the signs, is there a sign to indicate the presence of one of the bandits without it being an ambush situation? How would you, if somebody, say, appeared on the path in front of you, or... Was there a sign for that at all?
Well, yes, because, again, thumbs down enemy. And he'd had a point. And then he'd advance with his hands and put his palm downwards with calm, quietness. Up again, if it's ambush situation, which it has happened to me, he puts the hand grenade sign, means be ready with your weapons. Not so much hand grenades, but be ready with your weapons. Spread his hand over his face and then point left or right, that he wants the ambush set in there immediately because the enemy is approaching.
Was it emphasised in the training, the jungle training, the need for quiet?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was a bit of a laugh, because after our initial training and we got over the fright, experiencing the wildness of the jungle and the intensity of the jungle, the smell of the jungle, the fear that you had when you walk from the rubber, which was in beautiful formations of rubber trees, and you go into the jungle, there'd be a silence that would be like as if somebody clapped it. Wham! As soon as you went in there, wham, it occurred to you. And because it was all around you, it was close. Not a lot of movement of air as well.
Can you describe the kind of jungle canopy to me as well, what that looked like, and what the types of terrain you encountered in Malaya, just generally?
Generally, it covered all things. Swamp which was a terrible thing to go. Most of them weren't deep, waist high. And one of the swamps that we encountered, they had that red clay. So when you finished, when you came out, the clay dried on you and you were covered in red ochre. The animals there, creatures, were a lot of snakes, hell of a lot of snakes. Only one time was one of our chaps bitten. They do try and get out of the way. You encounter logs underneath the water and foliage, and that clings onto you. You've got mountain terrains that are pretty high mountains as well, steep as well. And when you get up, you can't see because the canopy is, the jungle is, the trees are so high. And they have a very big spread at the top because they're relieved to get to the daylight, whereas underneath there, sort of the trunks are bare. The undergrowth is sparse under the big trees, but then you get the shorter trees, which are more like big bushes, and you get a very thick covering of trees and bushes and grass. Grass as well, we used to call it elephant grass, up to our shoulder and above our heads, 6 foot high. Thin blades of grass looking more like bamboo, but it was grass. And you got to walk through there, you couldn't see anything, and all you'd hear was a shh as you're rubbing past it. You mentioned the fact of sound. We were very quiet, mostly, very seldom spoke. But you could smell the enemy, and they could smell you. They smelt of spices, and they said, we smell of sugar. Our body odours of sugar, theirs are spices, and our cigarettes they could smell, and we could smell their cigarettes. You got that thing as well. And also we encountered the fact that you get that, it's a primitive feeling where your hair stands on the back of your neck. And that occurs several times, and you turn round and you see a fleeting figure go across the track, where they've either been following you or heard you and gone across, and they didn't want to encounter you. Because towards the early stages of the British Army going there, they found out that they couldn't match our firepower. We would not run. So therefore they hit and ran. Before they'd stand and fight, because there was only the poor police or the rubber plantation people and civvies without any decent weapons, and they were spread, so they were the power. But when we came out there, we would not run. If we did run, we'd turn and then face them again.
The thing about noise, if somebody was to make a noise, because you said it goes quiet, obviously, once you enter the jungle.
Yeah.
But would noise travel then?
Does it, yeah. You can hear it from miles away. You can hear this crashing, and you think, so what the hell's going on? And when you go further, 2 miles further on, you'd go onto a path, and it would be an elephant path. Now, the Malayan elephants are very small, much smaller than the Indians and the Africans, and very, very private, secluded creatures, and they would force their way through the undergrowth, and that's the noise we heard probably an hour before, but they're 2 miles, 3 miles away. You could hear water very clearly, and you can hear a tap of metal and wood, and if someone's chopping wood, you can hear it resounding. Then when you have got an opportunity of looking over the valley, suppose and say the undergrowth dips a little bit and you're on the side of a valley, you can see smoke. That smoke can travel 12 miles. We had difficulty when they were feeding us from it with the air, with air drops. We'd lay the DZ out, which is a dropping zone, which is like fluorescent panels, and then set fire to a bonfire. But they couldn't see us because the bonfire, the smoke, he used to shout out, more smoke, more smoke. Well, it'd go up, catch the top of the trees, it wouldn't go beyond the trees. It would travel from tree to tree to tree, right down the valley. So they didn't know where the end of it or the beginning of it was. So we had to try and guide them in. And unfortunately, though they were, bless them, they were good, they're Australian crew. And they didn't stand any nonsense. You know, we're coming over once more and you've had it after that, boy. And if they didn't get you, they'd just fly off. So we said, well, we haven't got any. They're too tough luck, mate. Tough luck. See you next time. They wouldn't drop them anywhere.
What about visibility? You've mentioned a little bit about visibility, but how could you see in say a normal section of the primary jungle, how far could you see?
Well, the next bush, and if the bush is 2 foot away, that's all you could see. You couldn't see beyond that because it was so prevalent with his foliage. They were all healthy. You go and stand in Kew Gardens and into their big where the foliage is thick, and that's exactly what it is. You have to push. You can push a bush aside, and a person could be standing there. The other thing, difficulty is about that, when we used to make base camp, then you'd put a sentry out 20, 30 yards away so that he'd have give the rest of the gang a bit of warning. Well, at night time, you'd have a job to find him, so we'd have to put a string down. You couldn't see him. You couldn't hear him. He wouldn't say anything. You'd have to challenge as well because, well, we lost one bloke. We lost him all night. He just thought, I'm not going to wander around. And he was about half a mile away. And he'd gone to sleep. He just couldn't find us. So we had no sentry duty for that 3.5 hours that he'd been away. He just couldn't find us. He did call out. If you call out, you still can't find you. Because sound travels, it goes all around, like an echo chamber.
So you'd had this introduction with your training to what the jungle was going to be like,
yeah,
and acclimatisation for that 2 week period. What was the next stage? Where did you go from the training area?
Well, I wanted to go home. Like the rest of the place wanted to go home. We thought, well, this is nothing like what they told us it was going to be like. The terrain up and down hills, through the swamps and through the hot, humid elephant grass, and carrying the packs, carrying all your uniform and your equipment. We were then distributed to different companies, and we found out that the Suffolks were very, very low on manpower. A normal regiment is 1,000 men. They were down to just under 400. So with our influx of 40 men, they welcomed us with open arms. I think three of us from our lot, four, went to A Company, and the rest of them were B Company, C Company, D Company. Some of them went in the signals. And one of them ended up in the Pioneers, because he was a carpenter, and they found out that he was very useful. But he'd had all the training, and some of the blokes went in the company office, because they were quite academic. But they were really sort of fed up, the fact that though they'd had all the training, and then they seemed to think that we enjoyed these patrols. They admired, well, look, the lads have come. And we came back with all this red ochre and mud on our clothes, and we were knackered. A beard, we hadn't washed for 3 days. And they think, oh, yeah, they look like men. And so we went straight onto duties. And the duties were to show ourselves in the jungle, in the rubber, in the towns, in the villages. And if you encountered anything, we hoped that your training was good enough. And the first encounter...
Well, what was your, when you'd arrived with A Company,
yeah,
what was your first thing? Was it patrolling? And what was
that's what I mean. Yeah, it was patrolling.
Yeah, what was
away.
The area that you were actually patrolling in to start with, or was there different types of...
No, we were patrolling in a place called Segamat, which is Johor, southern Malaya. Only just probably 50 miles from Singapore, across the causeway. And that had all kinds of terrain, hills, mountains, valleys, grasses, rubber. There was rubber everywhere in Malaya, and tin mines. And we had to show ourselves, walk around the tin mines, to show the security forces that we were there to back up. And again, through the villages. And then... That was generally, all it was, patrols, in the early days. And then we started getting into the fact that, all right, you've shown yourself enough now. Now let's try and get the enemy. And the enemy were moving at night time. So we had night ambushes set up on main tracks. Information given by the police or information given by our own army blokes that these tracks are well worn. Let's put an ambush. And you stay there all night. You'd go in there at dusk and come out at dawn. And you stay there all night and you couldn't say a word.
What was that like to experience that at night? Because obviously you described a little bit about the jungle. But what's it like to lie in an ambush position all night in there? Is it uncomfortable? Is it unpleasant? Or is it not unpleasant or uncomfortable?
No, what you said in the first place is uncomfortable and unpleasant. Because you can't make a base, you can't take any tents or anything to build a basher at all, so you have to sit on a log or lay on the ground. And I hope that you haven't settled an ant's nest or animals or creatures that are around you. I put my ground sheet one time on the ground, cleared the ground from twigs and so forth, and laid down on it, and I felt this vibration and pushing against my back. I thought, what the hell is it? I put it on, and there was nothing there when I put the ground sheet down, but I lifted the ground sheet up, and this black mamba came out of a hole. And by God, can they shift? It took one look at me and then went like hell. Now, they're about 6 to 8 feet long, they are. And the mamba is a pretty fast-moving thing, and it's lethal. Well, he didn't want an encounter with me, no more than I wanted an encounter. But I'd put it over his hole. And he didn't know that, you see. So lots of blokes, I've heard them 2 o'clock in the morning, and jumping around, and I said, oh, no, he's got a red ants on him. I mean, there's thousands of them go all over you. And leeches, they leap, the leeches, no matter where you go, the bloody leeches get everywhere. In your crutch, under your armpit, the middle of your back, neck, on your chest. That's the only time I really sort of felt sorry for the non-smokers, because they have to put salt on the leeches to get them out, get their heads come out, because if you knock them off and their heads stay, they go poisonous. So with a cigarette, you tickle them up the backside and they pull out and think, oh, I don't like that, and then flick them off. And all of them got your own blood. And sometimes you encounter the ones we call elephant leeches. They're 6 to 8 inches long, but they usually go on cattle. Mind you, if you go on a human, Christ, it's enough to drag an armful away from you. You can't feel them either. You can't feel them.
How would they get on? Is it just from the vegetation, or if you travel through water?
Well, I've noticed, I've watched that, mostly in the damp conditions, and they sort of sit, they're just like a little pipe, with a narrow end with the mouth, and the fat end is the backside of the body. And they raise themselves upright, and they wave about. And if a shadow or heat comes by, they jump on. They just actually jump on. So they jump on your foot and work your way up, and they go to your heat of your body. And they get through your laces of your boots, in your underpants. You get them back of your neck, back of your ear, and you can't feel them. So when you go back and you strip off, you go into the showers, and there's about half a dozen of you on them. Ooh, horrible feeling. But go back to the ambush there. There you are, sitting there for 4 or 5 hours in an unpleasant situation, and you're irritable because you can't sit properly, you can't lie down. What's that? What's that noise? Something's coming. Give me one occasion, we saw this light coming towards us. We thought, what the hell's the light? It's walking down the track. So we all eased up our security cocks, and off it came, the safety catches, and I was going to let fly right in the middle of this light. And we found out it was the officer. Our officer, not a regular officer, had put one of these burners on a spoon because he went to have a pee and he couldn't find his way back. So he nearly got shot.
When you were in an ambush position, how would it be laid out at that? Would you choose your own positions, or would the officer lay you out in a specific...
No, you lay out in your formation that you marched in. You just go to one side and put yourself down. So your weapons were still evenly distributed with your automatics to your manual rifles. You wouldn't take your hand grenades off your belt because you knew where they were. They'd only hooked on anyway. Surprising that we haven't lost so many of them. And be careful of the fact that when you throw phosphorus, because that can blind you. You throw a thing and all you can see is just a big white light. So you've got to throw it well away behind you so it lights their figure up. We were successful, but you've got to be careful when you do fire, because I remember one occasion where we set up an ambush and it was on probably 30-foot bank, and we were at the top of the bank and we were going to go down to the bottom when the light faded and go back right next to the track. Well, before we'd made that decision, these two blokes had come along, two bandits, and we all saw them at the same time. They weren't making a noise at all. One bloke was tall, about 6 foot, with a big, big stomach on him, remember it? And he got a small pack. And the bloke was around about 5'3", and this massive great pack. We thought, that's justice for you. Proper uniform, sort of communist uniform. And the whole patrol let fly at them. We went rushing down there, even in the darkness, tripping over the logs and so forth, and couldn't find them. The officer heard the noise because he was living in the bungalow with the rest of the crew. Came racing down. How many have you got? I said, we can't find any. So the next morning we went back and all our bullet holes were 10 to 12 feet above the ground in these trees. We hadn't adjusted the gradient. And even though they got in our sight, I got him in my sights, it still was, the slope was too severe. Well, they got the packs, they soon dropped the packs off. We must have, all we did, we must have let 500 rounds out of them, but it must have frightened them to death. Very expensive.